Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Socially Savvy, broadcasting live from Carnation, Washington. I'm your host, LB Duchess. Today, we're going to be launching some fun, fantastic interviews that we did for this last weekend over Woodinville Passport, which was one of their fun spring kickoff events for the some of the wine tasting cellars in Woodinville. We have some very fun interviews with Elevation, Vortex, Jay Bookwalter, Brian Carter, Chocolate Shop, and DeStefani, to name a few. So give a listen in and enjoy the show.
Hello, this is LB Duchess, and I am here at the Woodinville Passport Wine Tasting Weekend. We're going to be interviewing some fantastic winemakers and wine cellar rooms, so listen in. This is LB Duchess, and I'm here at Woodinville Wine Cellars with winemaker Sean Boy, and he is going to tell us about one of the wines that they are tasting here at Passport Weekend in Woodinville Wine Country.
So this is our 2009 Reserve Cabernet Sauvignon. We make about 100 cases of this. Thought it'd be fun to showcase today as one of our top wines that we do. We keep this in cask for about 2 years. And in bottle for about 18 months before we release it to really get that real great synergy going and real smooth characters. And this is one of my favorite vintages we've worked with in Washington State. 2009 was a pretty hot vintage for Cabernet Sauvignon. It was a great outcome for this wine. Enjoy it. It's a favorite.
Well, what I like so much about it is it has a great nose as well as a great flavor. And sometimes the nose of the wine and the flavor don't always coincide, so it's confusing.
Well, I think it has a very classic Cabernet nose to it, so very varietal. A lot of times when you taste wines today, they may be good, but they don't really smell or taste like the grape it says on the label. So one thing I'm really proud about this wine is what it says about Washington State in general, and the Cabernet Sauvignon that is being produced here is really world class, without the price.
I love that. So tell us a little bit about Woodinville Wine Cellars, when you guys started it, and how long you've been with them.
Well, I've been here almost since the beginning. We started here in 2001, so we were one of the originals here in Woodinville. I think we were number 12, to be exact. I mostly started here in 2003 as a part-time helper, assistant winemaker here. And in 2005, I took over the winemaking here and have been rolling along since. So we do about 4,000 cases here now.
That is fantastic. So for somebody who's going to look to do wine tasting, what do you think is your point of difference? Because you guys are kind of out here off the beaten track. So I could tell our listeners right now that the wine is definitely worth driving out and checking out. But what do you feel is your point of difference?
Oh, well, definitely that the unique quality that we have here is that we enjoy being in an area that's not full of a lot of other wineries. And we like to be over here. We do our own thing. We make great wines, or we hope we make great wines. And we think that that does the marketing for us. So it becomes a destination spot for us that people talk about. Hey, go see Woodinville Wine Cellars over there. Because certainly from the parking lot, it doesn't look like what when you walk into our tasting room or you go along our creek here outside. We have a nice little park area behind us here, which we have summer events or people can come and just drink a bottle of wine.
Well, awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing and being a part of this weekend.
Okay, thank you very much.
And this is LB Duchess, and I'm standing here with Steve Stewart at Elevation Winery Wine Tasting Room here in Woodinville. And I understand you are the winemaker. So tell us a little bit about this fantastic, cute little tasting room and the wines you guys make.
Right. So we specialize primarily in Bordeaux wines, Bordeaux blends, so Cabs, Merlots, and red blends. And also, another one of my signature wines is Alsatian-style Riesling. It's kind of off-dry, one of my best-selling wines. So we're a little boutique winery. I do all my production in this room. All my tanks are stainless steel, except, well, I have stainless steel tanks and I have oak tanks, but they're all temperature controlled, so it gives me that little bit of extra control. I'm an engineer in my other life, so winemaker, this is kind of my retirement plan. So the engineer in me gets the better of me, and so when you come in here, you don't see equipment like this in many of the other boutique wineries. I've got some of the best equipment around, and I'm really, you know, I don't overproduce, so the small batches that I do make, I can pay a lot of attention to each batch, and that's kind of where the name Elevation comes from. So there's a French winemaking term called élevage, and when a wine has élevage, it means the winemaker took a lot of time and care going from the grape to the glass. So that's our, so it kind of translates to elevate. So I don't make wine, I elevate wine. And then our other elevation link is I'm an ex-ski racer, and I met my wife at 9,500 feet in the Snake River Saloon in Summit County, Colorado. So when we came up with the name Elevation,
it
fit us, so we went with it. So I make about 2,700 cases a year.
Okay.
We're in distribution. You can find our wines at all the better restaurants and wine shops. And we invite you all to come on in and try our wines. We try and make our wines just that little bit smoother than you're going to get anywhere else. I don't believe in over oak wines, so try and pay a lot of attention to just make some smooth, velvety wines.
Well, awesome. Thank you so much for sharing with us, and I'm going to go enjoy your wine.
Okay, thank you very much.
This is LB Duchess, and I'm standing here at Vortex Cellars with Ed Wickline, which rhymes with
Beerstein, as my grandma told me to explain it to people.
I love that. So we're sitting in this really cute tasting room. I love that you guys have art up here.
So, what do you think of this temple? Huh? You want a case of that, I bet, right?
Yeah. You're quite different than how you got into those.
I've been was a home brewer for a long time, making beer. One of my buddies, I made beer with, got me into winemaking. So I took the hobby and thought I wanted to do more with it. I went to school at South Seattle Community College for the wine technology program and started working in the wine industry, then making wines at other wineries. After a bit of that, we decided to branch out and do our own thing, focused on French Rhone-style wines and Spanish wines.
I'm going to love these wines, I can tell you right now. So you have been fabulous. You're participating in the Woodinville Wine Country Passport this weekend. What wines do we get to taste, and how do they differ from what everybody else is offering?
We've got five wines open today. We're starting with our Cascade White. It's a Viognier Chardonnay blend, which is a non-traditional blend, but it came together really nicely with light oak on it. Very moist. It's a really good range.
$25.
Okay, you have my attention because not only have I never been to Cascade,
there's things you said you can't do. The two-pack, I have been stepping out.
So I
I've got a little bit of our 2011 rosé left. We're pouring it today, mostly at the
takes longer.
And then following that, we've got our
new stop back
where the southern
you're welcome.
And finally, our most full-bodied red, our Tempranillo, is rounding it out.
Okay, you had me at Tempranillo.
So we do a couple styles of Tempranillo. This is our American-style Tempranillo that's on the bar now. I also do a reserve style, which we haven't released yet. And we're a newer winery, so that wine is still sitting in the new oak barrels. But we'll probably be bringing it out around the holidays this year.
I know you guys are packed here, but I
want to ask one more
question. Can you explain to
the
listeners what the difference is?
Well, the Spanish traditionally use a lot of new American oak and let the wine sit for quite a while, picking up a lot of really dry Spanish wine. Although it mellows nice after the bottle. The other one we did in the earlier style, we released it a little bit younger, and so it's got a little bit more fruit on it.
Oh,
and this is LB LB Duchess, and I am here at one of our favorite places, Apex. I'm sitting here with Hal Lanvoigt. He is the winemaker for the chocolate shop variety. And I'm really excited to hear about how you came up with this fantastically, I think of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory kind of thought process when we drink wine.
So I was in the North Cascades on a hike, and I fell and I hit my head, and when I woke up, I'd been captured by elves who took me to their hollow tree and taught me about their ritualistic beverages, and from there, that's what you get.
Okay, I love that story. That right there, it should be enough.
So really, it's a funny thing. Especially in the Northwest, we have a very diverse group of people, and a lot of the people that live here come from non-wine-drinking countries, and so I don't think they have that sort of ritual in their lives. They don't know about wine. They've never, it wasn't like they tasted it as kids and had that initial reaction where it's just weird or yucky, or they really liked it because they were that kind of kid. But I talked to lots of people when I was out in the market, and they would always come up to me and say, we don't like wine, but we really want to drink wine. And I heard that probably 20 or 30 times, and there was just one night I was laying in bed and I couldn't sleep, and I just, your mind goes to weird places at 3 in the morning, and I was thinking about it. I was like, no one comes up and says, you know what, I really hate Brussels sprouts and I really want to eat Brussels sprouts, but I've had all these people come up and say, I don't like wine, but I really want to drink wine. And I sort of thought about, what does that mean, and why is it that people want to have wine be part of their lives? And I think some of it, there's some upward mobility to that, where people feel like drinking wine is more sophisticated or more socially acceptable than beer or cocktails or other things. But I think there's so many health benefits for it, and we hear so much about wine that people really want to incorporate it into their lives, but they don't like the flavors. And so we'd done a little bit with sweet wines. We'd done some fruit wines with flavors, and I felt like wine and chocolate, those are both, when you make wine sweet, you really get into just pure fruit, cherry, strawberry, raspberry, just very clean fruit flavors. And chocolate is, everyone loves chocolate. It's just, it's cacao, it's vanilla, it's spice, it's sort of roasty coffee, chicory notes. There's really simple flavors that globally everyone can understand. And so I felt like if we could put those two together in a way that really made a much more, we toned down the acid, we sort of manage the tannins in a different way with sweetness and with fruitiness, that we could create a beverage that it would look like wine. People that weren't seasoned wine drinkers, so to speak, could feel comfortable at a party drinking that, and they wouldn't feel out of place, but at the same time, it was something that was more to their liking. And so that was, for me, that was sort of for me as a nerdy, very old school, this is how we make wine, this is how you do things. That was my justification for why we made it. And then after we made it, I had the opposite experience where I was at wine tastings and you have the chocolate wine and everyone thinks, oh, well, this is a women's wine. This is made for sort of the feminine set. And women would come up and they'd try it, and then they would say, like, oh, honey, you have to try this. And they would turn to their 280-pound boyfriend in the gold gym tank top, and he would taste it and be like, damn, babe, that's some good stuff. Like, we got to get this at home. And actually, they said that at about 8 octaves higher because of all the steroids. But at that point, you have enough of these interactions with people where it's not about gender, it's not about race, it's not about any sort of, it's just a completely different flavor set that I think we all can relate to. And so if you're a wine drinker, it's great because you still identify with the wine and there's these other flavors that you understand. And if you're not a wine drinker, you understand all of those secondary flavors, the chocolate, the vanilla, the sweetness, the fruit, but there's still enough wine there that it has meaningful impact for you. So it's a really sort of very broad appeal product.
Well, it's funny because the first time I ever drank the chocolate shop, it was a very different appeal because I'd been drinking wine for a while and had already started my wine studies. So my brain was trained to try to pick up on all the little nuances. And then I was introduced to the strawberry shop, and then I was introduced to the sparkling and the almond roca. So what I love that you guys have done is you've taken wine and you've made it its own dessert. You don't need anything. Anything that you put with your dessert wines actually becomes secondary, where typically a dessert wine is secondary to the dessert.
Right. And for me, I think there's a dessert aspect to it, but I've had enough. It's interesting. I've given it to people and had them come back, and they're like, well, I drank this with my mom, and we loved it. And I would say, well, did you have that with, like, strawberry shortcake, which is my favorite pairing for that, or did you have it with chocolate mousse? And they said, oh, no, we had it with, like, a ribeye steak and green beans and garlic mashed potatoes. And you're like, wow, like, I really, that's a pairing I would never put together in my entire life. But the thing that I always preach to people, and I feel like is the most important thing, is if it tastes good to you, like, I don't care what the rules are. Like, if you like that combination, then that's the place to start, and then explore from there and really sort of push the boundaries of what you're comfortable with from there, rather than taking what people say as a great pairing or a classic combination. And part of it was when we made the chocolate wine, I'd been doing wine dinners with Precept for 4 years at that point. And then we would always go to these dinners and we'd have these great red wines, and then they would put it with chocolate mousse or chocolate pie or some kind of chocolate dessert. And I never felt like it was, the chocolate is so sweet that it never really works with the wine. And so I knew it was possible to have chocolate and red wine together, but in general, when you have a dessert so sweet compared to a 80 or 90% cacao chocolate bar, that it doesn't really, the pairing doesn't work in real life in the same way that it works on paper. And so I felt like we could sort of re-engineer that flavor experience in a different way.
That is fantastic. It's so funny because I'm Mexican in some of my heritage, so the first thing I thought is chocolate chop with a mole sauce.
Actually, well, do I make a drink? We have a really un-PC name, which I won't mention on paper. No, I will not mention it ever outside of, like, very close company. But the idea is to create a Mexican chocolate-type flavor, because I love mole. It's one of the few things, every time I go to Mexico, I end up with, like, 8 kilos of Mayordomo mole in my suitcase that I'm trying to smuggle back. I'm like, well, I bought some mortar. I bought some spices. Like, you come up with a different excuse every time. But it's three parts of just the regular chocolate chop red wine, a shot or a part of Fireball whiskey, and a half shot of Frangelico. And you put that all in a shaker and shake it up, and it gives you really that full Mexican chocolate kind of nuance. You get the chocolate, you get cinnamon, you get spice, you get a little of that chili heat. But there's also that almond kind of hazelnut flavor that gives you a little of the, like, vanilla lactones and a little bit more of that, those softer undertones. And it's really, it's a nice drink. You can shake it, put it in, like, a lower alcohol chocolate martini, and it's delicious.
I'm so trying this. So besides that one, which is actually sounds like a delicious recipe, which of the chocolate chop wines, because my favorite is the chocolate chop sparkling, because I love sparkling wines, but is there a recipe for any of the other chocolate chop wines, like maybe the strawberry or something, that you have a favorite?
I think that it is wine, but I don't look at it as wine. I look at it as a mixer. And so with the sparkling I've just sort of looked at how do we use sparkling in the wine world, and then how do we reinterpret that. So we've taken mimosas and done things with pomegranate juice or like acai grape juice and different things and made mimosas that way with the sparkling wine. We've done things with sort of reinterpreting a Kir Royale. So you can use Kir, which is blackcurrant. You can use Chambord, which is raspberry. If you can find, I've done it with like Jaeger and some of the bitters, which gets you into a more sort of weird, sort of interesting herbal category. And you can do things just with sparkling chocolate. And if you want to go high octane, you can do Kirsch. You can do Austrian Schnapps, which comes in a whole, like, apricot, peach, pear. There's all of those fruits. Once you have fruit and fruit, it's pretty simple, and fruit and any kind of chocolate goes together really well. With the chocolate strawberry, there's a lot of sort of
I think you just have to sort of start thinking about those base flavors. So if you have chocolate strawberry wine, what goes well with that, you can look at things like Frangelico, which are more sort of almond liqueurs. You can then look to build in some sort of undercurrents, whether that's with like whipped cream vodka or cupcake vodka, so you can make a cobbler type of a drink. And it's really just, it's less about, I think people get, with drinks in general, they get very hung up on what are the classic cocktails. And with once you get into flavored beverages, for me, it's less about how do we make, reinterpret a Manhattan or a martini into a chocolate-flavored drink, is how do we take wine and different kinds of alcohol and create sort of liquid versions of desserts that we like, whether that's strawberry shortcake or a cobbler or a grunt or whatever it is, take those same flavor components, which are all out there, and sort of recreate them using these different alcohols and wines to create a liquid dessert instead of a carb, fruit, sugar dessert.
I love that. That is awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking time, because I mean, we've worked with you guys in Chocolate Shop forever and a day, and I never had so many thoughts about what I could do with the wine.
It's fun. It really is. I get new ideas every week. I try things. We've done, we do mulled wines, and it's, for me, because we make Chocolate Shop and we ship it all over the world, we get lots of input from people that ask for things that we wouldn't normally do. So we've had requests for chai chocolate wine. We've had requests for, like, pumpkin spice chocolate latte wine. Yeah, and I love, just the chocolate sparkling wine, I think, is a great, it's a little drier than the normal chocolate red wine, especially with the carbonation, the perception is drier, and it's a great, chocolate's such a great flavor in and of itself, and I think with red wine, especially more so than white wine, there's a lot of common flavors there, where if you think about pumpkin pie or apple pie or pecan pie, it's very easy to see how those flavors, that those red wine, dark plum, cherry, blackberry, fruit, and chocolate can work with brown sugar, cinnamon, nuts, graham, sort of pastry, baked pastry, brown sugar, sort of sweet cookie type desserts. And so it's fun to put things together in ways that in the summer I love strawberry shortcake and chocolate sparkling, because they're completely different flavors, but you can pull out the fruit from the sparkling chocolate wine and put that with the strawberries or the cobbler, and it works great. You can pull out the chocolate, and it goes great, obviously, with whipped cream. It goes great with, strawberry shortcake with grated chocolate on top of it. It's great. It becomes, it's a funny sort of a winemaking thing. There's a lot of focus put on very micro adjustment. Do we have enough? And so, do we have enough Cunois? Is there enough of Petit Verdot? Do we want to do like 3.5% or 3.25% Petit Verdot and these crazy little numbers? But when you get down to brass tacks of winemaking, if you just start with good wine and you're making a red blend, as long as all of the pieces are good, 99% of the time, those good pieces come together to make a good product. And you have to have some cultural referent or flavor referent or something that is meaningful for you, but whether you're, if you're Parisian or Persian or Italian or Mexican or whatever it is, or, you're from Minnesota or you're from Louisiana or you're from Seattle, Washington, every culture has different sort of groups of flavors that really are unique to that area of the world, and you have to just think about how do I make beverages, whether you're using my chocolate wine or not, that sort of reflect those flavors in my community.
Wow, well, thank you so much. One of the things I love so much about this is you're right, it is multicultural, and every culture has something where they attach to chocolate. So thank you so much. And if they're looking for your wines, I believe they can go to chocolateshop.com.
So chocolateshopswine.com. If you're in the Northwest, it's pretty much in every grocery store. We're in QFC, Safeway, Total, I believe BevMo, Fred Meyer, and if they don't have it, just go talk to their receiver or the steward and say we want chocolate chopped wine, and they'll bring it in.
Awesome. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
This is LB Dutchess with Socially Savvy, and I am here at Woodinville Wine Country's Passport Day 2. So listen to our interviews. And this is LB Dutchess. I'm standing here with Travis Maple, Associate Wine Maker, with Jay Brookwalter.
Yes.
How are you doing today? This is such a fun, awesome wine tasting room. I mean, you've got a great space for people to come and taste, and then you've also got this luxurious little lounge with leather couches.
Yes, and the patio makes it a real nice experience, too. We try to make it a very comfortable experience for all wine tasters to come through here, but it's more than just a wine tasting when you come to Brookwalter Wine. We really want to make sure that the consumer gets educated as well. We have some of the most knowledgeable staff around, and we do an extensive training program with all of our wine staff members here, including the ones from our Richland facility as well. We're continuously training all of our staff on winemaking styles, and all of our techniques, as long as our new wines that are always constantly being released as well.
Awesome. So now you guys have been here for a little while. What type of an experience should people expect when they come into your wine tasting room?
Again, kind of going back to the educational experience, we don't want people just to taste wines and just kind of leave here maybe with a little bit of a buzz. We want them to leave here with knowledge, maybe something that they didn't know about wines before they came in, and definitely just to actually get a better understanding of different styles of wines.
Very cool. And what kinds of wines do you guys, do you special in one particular type, or are you kind of all over the board?
We're kind of all over the board. John Brookwalter and I are really big fans of blends, but we do have all obviously our varietal dominance. We like to do Merlots and Cab Sauvs, but our higher-end wines are typically more Bordeaux-style blends.
Well, awesome. Well, I'm excited to go try some of your wines. Thanks for having us today.
Thank you.
And this is LB Dutchess at Brian Carter, sitting with the Brian Carter. And we're going to chat a little bit about his wine. So tell us a little bit about, you have a great space here, great tasting room, and some fantastic wines. Tell us how you got started.
Okay, LB, I've been a winemaker now for 34 vintages here in Washington State, and got here in 1980. And been having a lot of fun making wine in Washington State ever since. I actually moved up here from California, and where I was getting a degree in winemaking down there.
Wow! So you said you'd been associated with quite a few different along the way. When did you break away and start your own?
It was kind of a gradual process. I started making the Brian Carter Cellars wines when I was with Apex Winery in Sunnyside, Washington. Clear back in 97 is the first Brian Carter Cellars wine made. And then it wasn't really till 2006 that we opened up the Brian Carter Cellars tasting room here with a full line of Brian Carter wines.
So is there a particular vintage that you like to showcase, or do you like to play with the whole gamut?
Oh, I like to play with the whole gamut. And every vintage has its stars, and definitely right now we're selling wines here at Brian Carter from as early as 2007, and next week we'll actually be releasing a wine from 2012, our rosé.
Wow. So I got to come for the Woodinville Wine Country Passport today, and you were sampling two different wines, and the wine down in the lower area, that one is absolutely exquisite. Can you tell me a little bit about that one?
Yeah, that's a very special wine called Trenton Air, fairly limited production. And I think we're getting close to being sold out on that wine, but we kind of wanted to feature it. And it is a Trenton Air means of 30 years, so it is originally was released honoring my 30 years in the Washington wine business about 3 years ago. So it was great. It's a Petit Verdot-based blend, which makes it quite unique. It's a Bordeaux blend. It's got all five classic Bordeaux varieties, but it's mainly Petit Verdot, which makes it quite unusual. Very, very aromatic wine. Smells flowery. It's a characteristic of the Petit Verdot. Also a pretty big wine.
It is fantastic. It's actually one of my favorites from Passport this week. So one last question. For a new wine taster here, somebody would go around wine tasting in Woodinville, what would be a little bit of advice you would give them?
Well, don't try and visit too many wineries. Just pick maybe five or six in a day that you want to visit, and since there's over 100 wineries in Woodinville, you can't see them all. And even then, assuming that every winery has several wines to taste, you might even want to focus down on there. You might want to say just focus on tasting Bordeaux reds or Cabernets or Rhone reds, and then if you can corner the winemaker, then do so and ask them some questions and try and learn as much as you can about wine, whether it's from the winemaker or the rest of the staff. Here at Brian Carter, we try very hard to not only give people an entertaining time, but also make sure they learn something in the process, because the more you know about wine, the more you appreciate it.
I love that. That's one of, I think, my favorite things about Washington Wines is that most of the wine sellers that I've dealt with, that you guys really focus on education and helping people understand what it is that they love about the wine.
You bet. Yeah. Well, I've always felt that way, that wine can be a little bit intimidating to some people because there's so much to learn. But don't let that bother you. If you just learn a little bit every day, pretty soon you'll be an expert.
Well, thank you so much for taking time with us here at Socially Savvy.
Thanks for coming.
This is LB Duchess with Socially Savvy, and I have the privilege of standing here with Mark Newton of the Stephanie Wines.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic, and it's been so much fun doing the passport. I was really excited you guys were a part of it. I hadn't had a chance to really try any of your wines until I tried the Little Tasting Room over in Woodinville. But I have to say, my favorite place is over here in the Warehouse District, away from everybody else. You have a fantastic room.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. The interesting part about Passport is that I've been involved in every Passport from day one. And if you think about Passport, the original intent of Passport was a handful of wineries here in Woodinville who wanted to show off their wines. It was about opening up your cellars so people could come see the winemakers, see the cellars, enjoy those wines. Passport's changed a little bit over the years, but the original intent was to share the wines with the public.
Well, and that's kind of what I've gotten out of it, is we actually separated the whole weekend. I took the whole weekend off, and we focused on some yesterday and some today. I think it's a great way for people to kind of get to know each individual winery, and it's great to be able to meet owners and winemakers like you.
That's the intent. That was the whole intent of Passport, and that's the way it should be. I think there's some amazing wines that are coming out of Washington State, and there's some amazing wines that are being made here in Woodinville, which is just, 40 minutes outside of Seattle. And when you think about the wines coming out of our state, they're pretty amazing. I started making wines in 1983. There were 38 wineries in the state at the time. I guess I'm an old guy, but I still love making wine, and I love sharing those wines. So Passport's an opportunity for us to share those wines with people who are long-term clients that we've seen today, as well as new people that have never been here before.
Wow. So you started in 83. Did you start with your own DeStephanie?
No, we actually started under the name of Newton & Newton. My last name being Newton, my brother, who's a major grower in California, Newton, and I started out as a champagne maker or sparkling wine, however you want to do it. I started out in 1983 producing a sparkling wine using Oregon Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, and Pinot Meunier. And we were making sparkling wine in the traditional sense of whole cluster fermentation, whole cluster pressing, fermentation, in the bottle fermentation. We imported French Pupitres for doing all our riddling, classic. And those wines, those earlier wines under Newton & Newton, it's funny that people actually still remember the name after so many years and remember that it was some great, great sparkling wine. In 1991, I stopped making the sparkling wines and moved to the making the Sauvignon Blanc that we tasted today here at Passport, and then started making reds and fell in love with making reds too. So it's just,
It's very fun. And I know that today over here on this side, which was away from everybody else, you're doing a barrel tasting, and I'm looking at a glass that I have yet to try. I'm jumping out of my pants to try it. Tell us a little bit about this barrel tasting that you offered over Passport.
So this is, again, we think about Passports, but experience and providing an opportunity for people to see things that are different other than just going to a store and buying wine. So we thought we'd do a barrel tasting today, and we brought out our 2011 Sangiovese. And this is a wine that's in process, but it's a pretty damn nice wine to taste right now. And when we put it in the bottle, we'll probably blend a little bit of Cab Franc or maybe Le Carmenere or Cabernet. But, it's just showing that wine's about life, wine changes, and here's a great opportunity to taste a little Sangiovese and close out a wonderful weekend.
Oh, I love that. Now, you and I were talking earlier. You guys have an affinity towards cigars because of your own passion. Tell us a little bit about the cigar pairings, or I should say cigar wine dinners that you guys are doing.
Well, so I've been smoking cigars for a long time, good or bad, and we often think of cigars as like a fine wine. You know, the draw, the construction, the flavors, the location, the terroirs of the tobacco is all the same thing about wine. So several years ago, we started doing a quarterly cigar and wine dinner, and that's kind of been a tradition we've been doing for many years. But a couple of years ago, we actually created a wine specifically for cigar smoking. So we have a wine that we have called Cigarro, Italian for cigar, or Cigarro, however you want to say it. We say Cigarro, but it really Cigarro is the pronunciation for the Italians, which is predominantly Syrah, a little bit of Grenache. And the intent there was to come up with a wine that did not compete with a cigar, but the cigar compete with the wine. And if you're a cigar smoker and you like a nice great Robusto from the Dominican, a glass of Cigarro is about as good as it gets.
Well, I love it. Thank you so much for taking time for us, especially at the end of Passport.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to our interviews from Woodinville Wine Country's Passport this last weekend, where we got a chance to chat with some of the winemakers. On the end here, I'm adding an impromptu interview that kind of just happened as we were standing there before the interview, getting to know the winemaker and check out his wine tasting room. It's truly an example of what you get to experience when you go to these different tasting rooms and these different events. Hope you enjoy. Take care.
But there are craftsmen who made this.
Handmade
these. There are guys who went out and looked at the forest to have the stage split. To a French artisan cooper who then wine's been put in them. This is about 24 cases of wine in here.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the interesting part for me is 24 cases of wine, where would this wine go?
Whose lives will it touch?
And that could be an interesting thing in itself is to say, imagine tagging those 24 cases and see where they go.
Oh, my God.
If you want to talk about an interesting documentary, it's like, This will go to, this has the ability to go to somebody's graduation in college, somebody's wedding event, somebody's celebration of divorce, somebody who is completely depressed and is just sitting in their apartment in New York drinking a bottle of wine and eating takeout. I mean, all of these kinds of things that happen. And when most people come in here, they see barrels.
When you see life.
You see life stories.
I see the souls.
Okay,
let's
freaking cry. That is cool.
I love this guy.
Dude, I'm gonna come down here and have lunch every day just to hang out with him.
I don't really.
No, this is
I don't usually
awesome.
Talk
this
about
is,
this, but you have to understand the, like I said, the artisans who make it. And if you've never been to a barrel fabrication facility. There's a great one in Napa called Sugun Marau that you can go and see. When you see barrels being made, this is not like a Chinese factory making.
So from what I understand, the barrel making process is more like the cigar making process or even the wine making process, where it can be generations that they do portion.
Yes.
Like maybe their family has been doing the rings of the barrel for five generations,
that's right.
Or another one has been growing the wood,
timber.
The timber for 10 generations, and that's their participation in making this grape.
It is. So years ago, I thought about wanting to get into doing barrel making. And so I looked at doing barrel making with the intent of I had found the equipment to make barrels out of Great Britain and then found the sources in France to do the wood.
Wow.
It's about $1 million investment.
Oh, my God.
So, it's like if you look at it, I mean, there's more here than you really can imagine. So I started. One of the places I went to, the Behringer Winery, has their own barrel facility where they make barrels in Northern California that nobody really knows about. You can drive by their warehouse and you never know that they're making barrels in there. And the guy who's who's in charge of that barrel facility has been one of the major coopers in the U.S. Doing a lot of work on American barrels. And I called him up one day and said, I want to come visit you. And they were saying, great. It's one of these things where you go and you sit in the corner and you watch.
Quietly.
Quietly. And what and over the years we brought in a couple of different barrels. We brought in some barrels from South America. So the barrels, this is known as a stave, this is a head,
yep,
this is a crossbar. And you can go to France and buy what we call barrel sets, which are all of these have already been done. All you have, you bring them in, you can manufacture them. So there was a company in South America called Mistral, and there's a couple of barrels in there that we had purchased a couple of years ago, well, 4 or 5 years ago, to try them. And Mistral's experience was, we're going to take barrel sets coming into France, French Bordeaux, you know, French wood, and we're going to create the wines using infrared heaters and sensors versus we're going to use the fires that what you traditionally see.
Okay.
And so there's this world. So you go to Behringer and you start talking to people. It says there's all kinds of different companies, like Sigmund Moreau is another big producer, who have tried to do smell sensors and infrared and computer controls to toast the inside of the barrel.
So they're trying to dissect what makes a barrel.
They're doing typical what the Western world will do. Let's figure out what makes the best. It's not as good as the instinct of the heritage.
So you know what they end up doing?
Yep.
Fucking putting it on the shelf saying this is bullshit. So you go to Behringer, and what you have is you have a cooper, the head cooper, who puts these over the fire. And you know, they're splayed. Before these are bent, you know, the head's here and the wood's all splayed out, and they toast the inside of the barrels. It's all done by smell, by the cooper who's there watching the barrels being toasted by the fires. That is used from some oak shavings.
So it determines the smoky
the toast of
the barrel. Okay.
If you look on the inside here, you see right here, this right here is the toast that you'll see on the inside of the barrel. Subsequent, this has been machined, and that's been machined before they put the head on. But if you look on the inside of the barrel before you were to part wood in it, this is the toast that you would see on the inside of the barrel.
Very lightly.
Okay.
So we call it. Yeah. This is actually known as a heavy toast.
Yeah.
HT stands for heavy toast. But it's interesting shit.
Hey, you know what I love about it so much, and it's funny because we talked about the whole Daniels and the
people thought we were crazy about it. Dude, that's history.
We had to buy it.
I'm a cigar guy. Do you know that?
Oh, dude, I'm a cigar guy.
No. I was the cigar person.
He was cigar. I just loved 3 years.
I loved because of the heritage of cigars.
What's your name again?
I'm Mark.
Mark Brett Coffin.
So we've been doing we do a quarterly cigar dinner here, and we have been doing it for many years.
Oh my gosh.
It is.
I want to be here for that.
I started smoking when I was 20. I got out of college. I was 22, 23, dating this woman. Went to see her brother-in-law and her sister in Northern California, you know, like Marin. And the guy turns to me and he goes, "Would you like a cigar?" Why not?
Why would I say no?
Oh, my word. And it was a Royal Jamaican.
Cuban?
No.
Jamaican?
Royal
Jamaican.
Royal
Jamaican
was the name of the brand.
Okay.
Dominican.
Out of Dominican.
Jamaican.
Okay.
You probably, you know, but every once in a while you'll still see the brand, but it was Royal Jamaican.
Dominican still throws a ridiculous cigar.
Oh, great. So I've been smoking ever since. So I went through, I was smoking cigars before it was
popular.
You know, my favorites were things like, you know, the Hemingway short stories for short smokes.
Yeah.
And then also over the years, I do other stuff here, and I spend a lot of time overseas, mainly in Southeast Asia, where, you know, Cubans. When I'm overseas, I smoke Monte Cristo number 2s, Bolivars.
What do you think about my favorite Cuban is actually the Romeo and Juliet.
I've smoked them all.
Oh, my God.
Punch.
Punch throws a great one.
The
Anniversarios I got a chance to smoke a bunch of the Anniversarios 2000 from a bunch of those from the Cuban. Oh, my God.
She got me into it. It was her first time. It was her brother.
I'm Mexican, Spanish, and Cherokee. So, for me, I was enchanted by the history. You got 5 and 10 generations of just wrapping the cigars.
So to me, if you want to look at a family that's been in the world for making cigars, it's not Hemingway, but El Toro Fuente. So El Toro Fuente, the Hemingway series is one of the high ends for the El Toro Fuente family. But I was I was in Hong Kong staying at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, overlooking, you know, the harbor there.
You've lived a blessed life.
It's interesting. smoking my very first Cohiba Robusto.
Oh, my God.
And I can truly tell you, it was like, wow, this is really a fucking good cigar.
Sitting in a high-end hotel, he's like,
this is a great cigar.
And then, and then I was doing some business years later in Shanghai, and I was staying at the Shangri-La Hotel, and you know, it was one of these things, doing business, and I had a free day on a Saturday, and I went down to the lobby, and I was just going to smoke, and I had ordered a Cohiba, the Siglo. The big monster,
hey.
And I remember that.
No, just kidding.
No.
And the place was.
No.
That's really good.
Try.
It was. They were doing some kind of a Moet and Hennessy champagne by the glass kind of thing. And
God.
So I said to the waiter, you know, can I get a glass of champagne? This waiter is smart. The waiter looks and goes,
you're gonna have a glass of champagne with
this
that?
This is a very large cigar. I think you need a bottle.
Oh, that is beautiful.
They're a tank, dude. They're a tank.
But if you go up to our website, you will see in the pictures of our website some of our cigar dinners.
Oh, I'm going to check it out. I like
and,
that.
Yeah.
And they're.
Why don't you do this, Lisa? Why don't you?
And you came over here to do what?
I came over to interview you. So we're going to interview.
Thanks for listening to Socially Savvy tonight. Please go to our Facebook page, Socially Savvy, and like us, and let us know what your favorite shows have been to be entered into drawings from our sponsors for prizes. We want to thank our sponsors, Woodinville Wine Country, Apex Alder Ridge Wine Tasting Room, Brian Carter, DeStefani, Vortex Cellars, Girl of Girl Wines, Leone Wines, Woodinville Wine Cellars, Evolution Cellars, Jay Bookwalter, and Matthew Estates. Have a socially savvy week and make every event better because you were there.